And then the best was when he called us and said, I have this great idea for a narrator, but I'm not going to tell you. Would you give me permission to explore on trust? And we're like, of course, of course. And he came back and he's like, yeah, but George Clooney is willing to do it.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Documentary First, the show where we dig into the craft, the business, and the truth of filmmaking. I'm your host and a filmmaker myself, Christian Taylor. Every other week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's got another piece of this filmmaking puzzle that we all need to hear. If you haven't yet, would you please hit follow or subscribe wherever you're watching or listening? It's the best way to support the show. Now, this week, it's part two of my conversation with filmmakers Eric and Christopher Ewers. They are directors of the new PBS series, Henry David Thoreau. If you haven't listened to part one yet, I encourage you to go back and start there. We covered how they built their careers inside the Ken Burns universe and what it's really like to co-direct his brothers. Today, we get into why Thoreau's ideas are hitting harder than ever and how prescient they were, and about how funding documentaries, even with names like Ken Burns and Don Henley attached, are so difficult. And how George Clooney, Jeff Goldblum, Ted Danson, and Meryl Streep ended up in the film. Let's get into it. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends over at Virgil Films. With over 25 years of distribution experience, Virgil has released such hits as Super Size Me and the Oscar-nominated Restrepo, along with a trove of indie treasures like Forks Over Knives, To Die For, 7 Yards, and Speed is Expensive. Now, you can find all of those films, along with the entire Virgil catalog, on any transactional platform out there, like Amazon, Apple TV, YouTube, Tubi, and the rest. Are you a filmmaker and you're having trouble with distribution? Talk to Virgil. They work with every major platform directly, and they offer a variety of deals that fit with every filmmaker's needs, from standard distribution to service deals. They do it all. And they don't just distribute films. They elevate them. Truthfully, they're just really good people to work with. So if you want to learn more, head on over to virgilfilms.com and tell them Christian Taylor sent you. And now, on with the show. And on that note, Chris, why don't you explain a little bit what you meant by that? Because I'd like us to unpack that Thoreauvian mindset, just what this film talked about, what he meant. So unpack that a little bit.
Well, the big takeaway, as Michael Pollan says it beautifully in the film, Thoreau asks us to wake up politically, environmentally, but personally. He asks us to stop and recognize where we've been sleepwalking through life, right? What we allow that like quietly diminishes us, but also where we have agency. He's like, his work is a call for us to live deliberately and to constantly ask questions of society and of ourselves, most importantly, and to reevaluate, you know, our values, our choices, you know, our opinions, and to freely change course when we realize through paying attention, right, freely change course to something that feels right or feels more right or feels better, feels truer. So when Eric says that he's been very confident as an editor for a long time, but never really knew himself, you know, that's the whole point, you know, through the exercise of his life, through the experiments of his life, knew himself better and in a way that most people never do. And in doing so, he's able to have a fresh perspective on the outside world and its shortcomings for all intents and purposes. But it's very Thoreauvian.
What I thought was remarkable is how prescient it was for today. You know, he talked a lot about how consumerism was beginning to consume his culture early on. He was remarking how the dams were beginning to destroy the fish's habitats and migrating. And he saw, you know, it was all in the guise of more clothing that we really didn't need. It was just people just wanting to have more. And I just watched, I don't know if you've seen the documentary By Now, which isn't necessarily a fantastic documentary, even though it's on Netflix, but the concept behind it is completely true. It's outrageous, which is what the world is doing to trick us into buying more.
B-U-Y, Buy Now?
Yes, Buy Now.
Got it. Clever.
Because the woman that perfected the one-click buying on Amazon and curated all of the pages to make sure that as soon as we thought we needed something, we would go to Amazon and put it in our cart,
She's on there because she got fired from Amazon from trying to hold them accountable for stuff, telling how she did those things.
And here's a guy from the 1850s.
Yeah.
Who wrote, "The cost of a thing is the amount that I will call life, which is required to be exchanged for it." Like, right. Okay, you want that new iPhone. How much do you really want it? Are you willing to sacrifice all of this time just generating another iPhone that you could be using in Thoreau's, you know, Thoreauvian world to be appreciating nature or exercising or making art or whatever it is that makes you happy? And it's just uncanny that he is seeing all this at the birth. And this is the important part of what you're saying. It's the actual birth of the Industrial Revolution.
It's the birth of it. I mean, it's just starting.
There aren't any trains.
I know. Trains,
to him, he's like, this is speeding up life.
And yet, contradiction, he begins to take the trains.
Yes, so that he takes it 70 more. Times.
It is interesting because, you know, it does make our life livable. There is that contradiction. And, you know, wait till you watch the show and you learn the facts about the iPhones and how they make them and what they do for our lives, or the computers and what's happening, you know, in terms of nobody planning for the end of life of these things, you know, and you begin to see our responsibility, which is what he's talking about, the concept of living to work versus working to live. We've lost that. We've completely lost that life balance. And that's actually something I want to move into next off this philosophical discussion. Chris, you and I had this discussion offline before we started, which is, as filmmakers, we are in a very difficult time. We're living this out right now. We can't just make the things that we're passionate about because it costs an incredible amount of money. And right now, our industry is completely upside down, and it's very difficult to sell anything and make any sort of return, even if it's a narrative film, but much less a documentary film, if you're an independent filmmaker. But even if you're an established filmmaker at a studio, it's difficult these days. I always encourage people on this podcast to think from the end back. You cannot think, I want to make this thing. I want to make this thing and let's get started. Won't this be great? And you can't if you actually want to be successful and make a living being a filmmaker. So why don't you talk to me about how you have walked this line, or your thoughts about this whole part of it? Because I know it's something you're really passionate about.
Yeah, I think that, two things. First and foremost, if you're passionate about storytelling and you leap so far ahead that you're thinking about, how am I going to pay for this? Where is it going to end up? Where's it going to live? Who's going to distribute it? Whatever. You may start thinking about it logically, or you may just never start.
That's true.
We're in a unique place for our lifetime, right? But it's not unprecedented. I go back and forth, and anytime that I start to get really nervous about the state of the industry, film, television, I have to pause and remind myself about a handful of things. And we'll start with Henry. You know, humankind, our society has gone through several revolutions. And at each point, I have to put myself in the mindset of the people that were alive at that time. To use Henry as an example, he's growing up as a boy, very agrarian society. And then the Industrial Revolution kicks in, and all of a sudden, it seems to the people who are alive at the time that their ways of life are dissolving. Everything is changing. Everything is new. Nothing is safe. We talk about it in the film that at this point, like, you know, many farmers, generational farmers, their children would end up leaving the farm for the first time in five generations and looking for work in factories because, you know, the land, there was not enough land, or there's not enough, you know, the economy has changed to the point where they're forced to do this. They're forced to break out and do something completely unnatural and new to them, right? And of course, that's got to seem like an absolute crisis at the time. But fast forward 40 years, and all of a sudden, you know, collectively, we're acclimated to the Industrial Revolution, and now we can't live without the train or the, you know, et cetera. The same thing happened. So I went to film school in in, now moving in directly to relate to the film industry. I went to film school in the late 90s where, you know, and Eric was the same. Like we were filming with 8, 16 or 35 millimeter. I never shot with 35 millimeter because that was super fucking expensive. But like 8 millimeter, 16 millimeter and cutting on a Steenbeck, you know, like we're actually cutting and splicing the film together, you know, whatever else. And right about the time that I was leaving film school, the digital sort of revolution was taking place in cameras. And, you know, for me at that time, it was a godsend because I wanted to start making films. I wanted to start telling stories. But coming out of film school, knowing that I couldn't afford film, I couldn't gather the crew together that I needed, et cetera, it was almost impossible for one person to tell a story. Income digital cameras, right? So the industry at large bemoans digital cameras and thinks that it's going to be the death of film, et cetera. It wasn't. It's a new tool and it democratized in a large sense how we tell stories, how filmmakers or photographers can work and work faster and better and cheaper. It didn't change the art. Here we are in an AI revolution, you know, and of course, yes, it's super disruptive. The film industry is reeling right now for a number of different reasons, whether it be, you know, COVID or strikes or fires or tax incentives or, you know, whatever else. Now, boom, comes AI and vast majority of the industry is crying wolf. We're all up in arms saying that this is going to be the death of acting.
The sky is falling.
The death of creation, the death of film, the death of this, that, and the other thing. And I disagree. I think I felt that way at first. I was seeing Nano Banana and these image generating AI models coming out and the stuff that they could do in 5 minutes. Like, yeah, it will ruin certain professions. You know, like I wouldn't want to be a retoucher, you know, like stuff like that.
It's creating. As a voice actor, it's a challenge.
Sure. Absolutely. But it's going to be a challenge for everybody in the creative industry for a while. But then we're going to figure it out, I believe, just like we did in the Industrial Revolution and the digital revolution.
And you're going to need humans.
100%. 100%. Yeah. But the AI, you know, like we're going to realize that the AI is going to be the new tool to help propel storytelling. So I'm not as doomsday about it as some of my colleagues are, some of my friends, you know.
Go ahead.
If I may. Mm-hmm. You know what still is and always has been super important?
Tell me.
Best piece of advice I've ever been given in my life professionally was that the true reward for a job well done is the opportunity to do it again.
Mm-hmm. So true.
It has nothing to do with pay or credit or acknowledgement or, you know, what have you. It is, if this is the industry that you want to work in and you want to continue to work in it, repeatedly over and over and over again, the most important thing you can do is a good job, is to be like a team player and to be somebody that other people want to collaborate with, want to interact with. That is just invaluable advice because that's never going to change ever.
That's very, very true. Now, I will say it is still challenging. The reason I say that is I've done a film. It's done very well, and I'm still having difficulty getting funding for the next one. It's halfway done. I have lots of stories to tell and the ability to do it and a team that can help me. And having the ability to do that now in today's society is incredibly difficult. Now, does that mean it can't be done? No, I'm not giving up. I'm not going to quit. I'm doing what I can do while I'm continuing to look for the next opportunity. And my point is, that's what we have to do now. We have to look and plan. I'm not going to stop with my projects or my plans, but I am going to be super intentional about the budgets and developing relationships for distribution and trying to figure out how to solve this puzzle. We just have to be intentional about networking and making our budgets smaller because, you know, we're going to be making less money as documentary filmmakers. We have to educate ourselves on the industry, who the people are, what is happening out there, reading the trades. There's just a lot of simple things that we can do to educate ourselves about what the changes are. Learn AI. Don't be afraid of it, right?
100%. Yeah. I mean, in any creative endeavor, money is always the biggest hurdle, and it continues to be, and it's getting worse and worse.
I wanted to ask you about that because you guys did it with PBS, and I think before you came out, or maybe maybe it was after, CPB got their funding cut. Mm-hmm. Was it before you had funding or after?
So we're in a unique position because none of the films that we make, sure that so far they're all for PBS, none of the films that we make rely on federal funding. Okay. The films that we make are funded because it is through a nonprofit, WETA, and PBS, of course, is nonprofit. So all of the funding for our projects thus far are essentially charitable donations. You know, the money is raised through grants, through foundations. The money is raised through individuals of wealth who are passionate about the topic. And it has become, admittedly, extremely difficult to do. Whether it's our responsibility, which makes it even harder because we are not good at it, or we have executive producers. I mean, in this case, speaking of the Thoreau film, our two executive producers, Ken Burns and Don Henley, with names like that attached to the film, you would think that it would blow the doors open, to funding, but it's the exact opposite. And I will say that the single reason, the only reason that this film has been made and is now being promoted and will be aired is Don Henley. Not that he, personally funded the film, but he was responsible. He was had the lion's share of the responsibility because of his passion for it and because of his connections. To open doors to pathways, for funding for the project. Eric and I can't overstate that any more than that. It is absolutely the reason why the film is being made.
I remember when I was watching Ken Burns' masterclass and I was in the middle of my own fundraising, and he told me that he has two binders sitting on his desk of rejection letters from fundraising. Yep. And I started bawling my eyes out. I was like, what? Ken Burns, you've got to be kidding me. How is that possible? And that was back when. Yep. But I guess it still happened.
Super interesting. And then you can move on to whatever you want. I just want to say, if you or your listeners have ever seen a Netflix series, or at least it lives on Netflix now, called The Movies That Made Us, it is a phenomenal look behind the curtain at some of the most culturally significant touchstone films of our time, E.T., Raiders of the Lost Ark, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it is the stories about how these films were almost not made.
That's right.
And watching, I devoured this series, and I go back to it frequently because when I watch this and I see that Steven Spielberg has a hard time sometimes getting films made, George Lucas was almost unable to do X, Y, and Z, that, it makes me feel better, my own shortcomings and my own struggles. Because, it's this way for almost everybody.
It is encouraging. That's so true. Thank you for that. Okay, I do want to move on. We're going over time, but this is just such a fascinating conversation. The next thing I want to ask you is, so many people Google how to make money with PBS documentaries, or how do I get my documentary on PBS? Can you help us with that question?
I would love to find that website myself.
Yeah.
If you know of it, please let us know.
Yeah, for real, what we do is full of integrity and responsibility and ultimately satisfaction, personal and social satisfaction. But it is, I can't sugarcoat it for anybody. It is fucking hard, as it's always the case with film and television. Who you know can be crucial to the success or failure of a project. How persistent you are also is crucial to the success or failure of a project. One of our great friends, David Sieri, who's our longtime composer and just an absolute fucking genius. We were talking one time 12 years ago. Somebody was asking him how, because he's a musician and he lives and breathes music and it's his passion. Someone asked him, because they were astonished that he was able to make a living as a musician, and how do you do it? And he says, well, I'll tell you, the first thing and most important thing is to live cheaply. He was living in Harlem at the time. He's like, you got to have an inexpensive apartment because that's the sacrifice, right? I echo Eric. If somebody can figure that out, in the time of AI, believe me, I have used ChatGPT to answer that question. It is not worthwhile.
And then somebody must have taken the mantle of getting your show on PBS away from you and did it themselves. Yeah.
Well, Ken is executive producing, and by virtue of him executive producing, we have the privilege of being associated with his brand, if you want to call it that. That's why at the beginning of all our films, it starts with Ken Burns Presents. Right. He also is doing this with his daughter and her company. And he has also done it with Barrick.
Goodman.
Barrick Goodman, another filmmaker. And, you know, for all I know, there are others that he's doing this with. These were kind of what they loosely call legacy projects within the Ken Burns world. I think, you know, that is 1,000% a privilege. Mm. And we are able to develop relationships with WETA in Washington, the PBS affiliate that does all of Ken's films. And it exposes us to the intricacies and the, at times, inherent obstacles that come along with the territory of a broadcast partner. So I kind of liken everything that Ken has done for Chris and I as tough love, with the best of fatherly intents, just like your own father would. It's a process. We have to realize how difficult the filmmaking world is. We have to realize how hard funding is. I think a lot of people probably assume that we've been fed on a silver platter. While we're definitely not at that level of having to do everything by ourselves, this has not been an easy 20 years developing our company, developing our films. And I, honestly, my appreciation for Ken just continues to go up and up and up because he knows that. And he knows it's hard. And he does not want us to have a silver spoon in our mouth. It's a gift that you have to earn. So I do think that we face a lot of the same and similar obstacles that a lot of filmmakers face. And it's for all the right reasons. So how to negotiate PBS? Well, it's on a case-by-case basis. There's no one path. We've had to stand on our own with WETA and PBS often, mm-hmm. and we face the same challenges. So I think we can relate to a lot of people out there, even though in some ways, here I am, a 37-year veteran of Ken, almost full-time. I think maybe a year and a half of unemployment downtime since 1990. Mm. Some could say I'm a spoiled brat in some ways. No, I'm just lucky and I'm privileged. And it doesn't fall short on me, that gift that Ken and his company and Paul Barnes as the senior editor and my mentor have given me is something that I just try to take forward and do what I can to help other people and grow other people in the same fashion.
Yeah.
The true reward for a job well done is the opportunity to do it again.
Absolutely. Great, great quote. The only thing I can contribute to this conversation about this issue is my distributor, Joe Amadei of Virgil Films Entertainment, who I adore and must thank him for supporting our podcast, did get us in with American Public Television, and they were willing to take The Girl Who Wore Freedom if I would cut it down to 56 minutes, which I couldn't do because I had made a 89-minute film, not with the idea of putting it on public television. And had I cut it down to that, it would have destroyed the integrity of the film. And so I could not, within that framework, you know, put it on American Public Television. So that was a hard lesson. I should have made a shorter version.
No.
Coulda, woulda, shoulda. Film needs to be as long as it needs to be.
Exactly. Also, you may want to revisit that conversation. As we're all very well aware of, like, the broadcast model is this concept that the vast majority of us are still relying on broadcast television for our content is just factually inaccurate. We have already transitioned from broadcast to streaming.
That's true. I mean, I watched your documentary. Well, I guess I watched it I watched a streamer copy, but I mean, I watched the American Revolution on PBS documentaries on Amazon.
Yeah. And so what that means for us, for creatives, for projects, is that, of course, with broadcast television, yes, there are very strict time limits, time constraints. One of our episodes for the Thoreau Project, Eric did cut 5 minutes out of it just to fit the broadcast time slot. But the streaming version has that 5 minutes added back in. My wife and I love The Pit. We just watched the most recent yeah. episode last night. It just does my heart good when I go to like all episodes and one's 33 minutes, one's 45 minutes, one's an hour and 7 minutes. It's like,
there's,
you know,
the story.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So, yeah. So we're moving away from, and so is PBS, mind you, like, as I just mentioned, yes, we have a shortened version for broadcast of one of the episodes, but you know, the full, it's no longer the director's cut. You know what I mean? It's like, you have streaming content that can live in the cloud in perpetuity at whatever length it needs to be, you know? So again, another one of these concepts that has taken the industry maybe a little bit of time and maybe no time at all, but like, it's one of these concepts that we've come to embrace that is a benefit to our creative endeavors.
And I think the big difference between what you described in your experience and ours is that, first of all, we got lucky. The arc of each episode was perfect for us. Episode one being his childhood up until he's a mid-20s kid who doesn't know what to do with his life. So what does he do? He goes to Walden Pond and tries this big experiment living alone in nature. That's episode two. And then at the end, he says, perhaps I have several other lives to live. That's episode three, his later part of his life. They all fell, the arc all fell beautifully. But A, Chris and I didn't want to make a 2-hour film per episode. I think attention spans change, and I think the expectations of your audience change. So we endeavored, part of our vision was to create our episodes. And I think the difference is that as I was editing, unlike yourself, I was very mindful of length, knowing it has to be at the most 52 minutes and 45 seconds before end credits for it to fit the PBS time slot.
Right.
And ultimately, when we got to episode three and realized that if we cut any more out of this, we're actually cutting important content, then in the last 3 months of editing, I made sure that I incorporated little latches, if you will, where I knew I could end this scene and start and have a moment and then start the next one and be able to lift it out effortlessly. So I actually pre-planned while we were getting ready to lock the film, I pre-planned those 5 minutes so that it would not hurt the overall arc of the story. But when you have that ability.
It was not your first rodeo.
Yes. And you have that ability to do it in process rather than finish it and say, oh, crap, I got to go and take, you know, 89 minutes to 60. That would be a whole different story.
All right. Well, this has been a Sunday of a conversation, and now I need the cherry on top. I have to ask you about working with these celebrity voice talent. I mean, George Clooney and Jeff Goldblum and Meryl Streep. I mean, just some of my favorites. And I know there is an interesting story about Jeff Goldblum. So let's start with him. How did that happen?
Yeah, I mean, this was an embarrassment of riches. I mean, like, we couldn't talk, you know, again, who you know.
Never imagined.
Yeah, never imagined. Yeah, so, I mean, you know, Thoreau is a very enigmatic and interesting character, you know, and Eric and I, at least, always were keenly interested in Jeff as the voice for Thoreau, because I mean, he himself has just such a great character and personality and idiosyncratic, you know, nature, and the way that he imbues how he speaks and the words that he uses with, you know, with feeling, with meaning. I mean, like, we just thought he'd be perfect. Several years ago, in the commercial world, I had worked with Jeff on a spot, and in between takes, this was right around the time that Ken's Country Music series had come out. So in between takes, he's like, God, guys, has anyone seen Ken Burns' Country Music? Oh my God, it's so amazing. And you know, how he goes and goes on and on and on. And I kept my mouth shut. I never said anything, you know, at the time. Cut to, we're looking for voice talent for this project. And I was like, well, I think Goldblum could be amazing. And I know he's a huge Ken Burns fan. So threw caution to the wind, reached out to his agent and told him the story and the backstory, whatever else. Lo and behold, after a couple of emails back and forth, we get this very curt email from his agent says, Jeff would love to do it. It's like, yeah. So,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's.
Yeah.
Total happenstance. It's serendipity.
And then the rest, Mr. Henley has lots of connections. He lives in LA and in Dallas, but we would chat with him and we would brainstorm different ideas for other people. And, again, we're very lucky and very privileged, and it's not lost on us that, Don said, I know this agent for Jeff, but he's also for Ted Danson. And Ted has been a very big supporter of the Walden Woods Project and other environmental groups. And it was a very easy ask and a very, very straightforward, absolutely. Ted and Mary called us, Chris and I, to talk about the project and come
on Thanksgiving.
Yes. And come to find out that Mary wouldn't have, this is her own words, I wouldn't have probably been an actress if it wasn't for Thoreau. She played the role of Lydian Emerson in a play in college, and she did it so well. It was a play on Thoreau that the department head for the theater department or something said, you need to go to a different school. You're really good. And she did.
Wow.
Also, okay. Their son-in-law wrote his graduate thesis on Henry David Thoreau. So there was this like wonderful little, serendipitous connection to Thoreau. And then Don was willing to reach out to Meryl Streep, and he went off and succeeded in that. And then the best was when he called us and said, I have this great idea for a narrator, but I'm not going to tell you. Would you give me permission to explore on trust? And we're like, of course, of course. And he came back and he's like, yeah, George Clooney's willing to do it. And when we go to do the 2-day session with George, and George loves to chat. He is such a, they're all wonderful gentlemen, and Meryl Streep is a wonderful lady, but he, very genuine people. But he, I said, so, how long have you known Don Henley? He's like, I don't know Don Henley. We're like, what? And he said, yeah, I got a call one day, and someone handed me the phone, said, would you speak to Don Henley of the Eagles? And George was like, if Don Henley calls and asks you for anything, you say yes. And so it was just this wonderful,
that's beautiful.
It was Don's passion for the film. He wanted it to be the best it could be. And he really, like all other aspects of this project, we're so indebted to him and to Kathy Anderson, his executive director of Walden Woods. The two of them, there wouldn't be a film without them.
Amazing. Yeah, those voices really elevated the story. Same was true for American Revolution. Every single time they come on, I'm like, oh, that's Tom Hanks. Oh, that's Meryl Streep. They just are so gifted, at their job. And it doesn't matter who they are. They fully inhabit the characters they are playing. And what was it like to direct them? Do you direct them or do you just let them do their thing?
It's a little of both, I think.
Depending on who it was.
Yeah, depending on who it was.
Who was hardest to wrangle? I'm guessing Jeff.
No.
God,
no?
No, not at all.
You know what's so great about him? Like, he'd be in the booth and, we're prepping the next paragraph, the next bite, right? And Jeff would ask for like a little backstory. It's like, what do you think, like, what was happening in Thoreau's life? And what do you think, And then, very Goldblum-y, he'd be like, we'd tell him and he'd be like, oh, okay. And he's like, got his eyes closed and he's speaking into the mic. I am this, that, and oh yeah, I'm doing, okay. And I'm feeling this. Okay, great. And then he would just go and it'd be perfect. It's like, oh, okay, well, this is
amazing.
Easy. Yeah.
I think Ken gave us great advice. I asked him about Meryl Streep and I was like, when she was Eleanor Roosevelt, and I asked him back then, I said, how do you direct Meryl Streep? And he goes, oh, you don't.
Yeah.
He says, no, you sit back and you enjoy the ride. And every once in a while you make a comment, but I can personally guarantee that the comment almost always is, oh, wow. Oh my God. Wow. And I think you have to, with any kind of celebrity, you have to see where they, what they're comfortable doing. George said to us, tell me if I suck. And he said it that way.
Really?
If I suck, tell me I suck.
That sounds like him.
And he didn't suck. I couldn't believe how much of a natural he was. We just told him what kind of style, gave him some examples, and off he went to the races.
Wow. That was amazing. Well, your directing was impeccable for all of those voice talent, I got to say, for sure. Well, this was just such a delightful series to watch. I thank you for making it. This conversation has been enlightening and inspiring. I just have loved getting to know you. I know our audience will as well. We're going to have to divide this into two podcasts. We've gone a little bit over. I'm going to let you go. But first, we do have to do everybody's favorite segment, DocuView Deja Vu. All I'm going to do is ask you for a documentary that our audience might love. I'm starting with Eric. Come on, Eric.
Okay. What? Okay. It's more appropriate, Chris, because my answer will be very quick.
Okay.
I do love documentaries, obviously, but I also have a hard time watching documentaries sometimes. So my list is very short, but the ones that stand out in my mind, way back, Crumb.
Never heard of it.
Is it Zweigoff? I think is. It's Crumb is the story of a very eccentric, odd 60s cartoonist and sometimes nearly rated X material. And the guy was so off the beaten path. It was a fascinating character study. I would also say Hearts of Darkness is a given, the documentary behind the making of Apocalypse Now. Yero Dreams of Sushi is one of my favorites. Slice of life about this guy who creates some of Japan's greatest sushi, and it's like in a subway.
Interesting. You three already. You started off by giving me the disclaimer that you wouldn't going to give me any. Now I have three.
All right. One more. Thin Blue Line. Paul Barnes edited it. My mentor.
That's great.
So those are
good
mine.
Good one. All right, Chris, you're up.
I'm only going to give you one. It's my favorite of all time. Man on Wire.
I haven't seen that one.
Seen Man on Wire? It's about Philippe. I forget his last name. He's the gentleman. The tightrope walker who strung a cable between the World Trade Center towers in 1974 and spent an hour up there just walking back and forth and lying down. I mean, it is masterful filmmaking. It's a phenomenal film. I would recommend it to anyone and everyone. The whole story, of course, is told after the fact, right? In remembrance. And even though we know that he lives, and even though we know that, that it was a successful coup, essentially, the manner with which, the recreated situations is handled is nothing short of perfect. The filmmaker's ability to imbue the visual components of the film with information is a masterclass. In storytelling, visual storytelling.
Sweating just thinking about it. It's making me so nervous.
It's one of the most beautiful and well-made and most interesting documentaries that I have ever seen. Wow. And
gracious, that is a huge recommendation. Well, I'm just going to leave you with Buy Now. I think you need the information. I don't think it's a stellar documentary, but I think the information is what everybody needs. So. All right, gentlemen, thank you so much. This has been amazing. I can't wait to have you back for your next documentary. Is there one in the works?
Several.
Yes.
Several. Yay! Glad to hear it.
We just need funding.
Yeah. Join the club. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell, and you can be the one to tell it. All you got to do is get some money. All right. Amen. See you next time. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.